Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello everyone and welcome to New Books in Folklore. I'm Rachel Hopkin, I'm one of the hosts of the channel, and today we'll be hearing from Anne Farrell. Anne is an Associate Professor of Folk Studies at Western Kentucky University, or WKU, which is where I actually first met her way back in 2010. Then I was embarking on my Master's in Folk Studies and she just joined the faculty. 8 short years later, she's now director of WKU's Folk Studies program. She's also editor-in-chief of the Journal of American Folklore, and she's an award-winning author. The book that she's joined us to talk about today, which is called Burley, Kentucky Tobacco in a New Century, won the American Folklore Society's Waylon D. Hand Award. Anne Farrell, a big welcome to New Books in Folklore.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled to be here with you, Rachel.
So Anne, before we get to this wonderful book, I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself, in particular about how you came to be a folklorist.
Okay. Most people come to folklore in a meandering sort of way, and I certainly include myself in that category. As an undergraduate student, I was a women's studies major and became really interested in fairy tales and myths and sort of ways in which gender, in a very simplistic way, seemed to be taught to us through narratives, traditional narrative. I didn't have a folklorist there to guide me, but once I had graduated and was working, I worked for a few years in a shelter for women and children experiencing family violence, and somehow in my mind, I sort of had a connection that was very vague and, again, simplistic. But this idea of gender roles and expectations as being grounded in some ways in tradition. And my previous advisor from my undergrad days said to me, as I was talking with her about potential graduate school options, she said, you know, I think there's this discipline called folklore. And so I ended up at Western Kentucky University, doing my master's beginning in 1997, I believe, seven, and found that few folklorists were asking the specific questions that I was interested in at the time, and yet found that really folklore had an opportunity for those kinds of questions and, of course, many, many others. So that was sort of my meandering route. I then finished my degree here at Western and then worked for the state government for a few years and then went on to Ohio State where I received my PhD. And then was thrilled, as you said, to come back to Western Kentucky University in 2010. And I'm happy to still be here.
Yeah, and I'm following in your footsteps at least up until coming to OSU. So
yes.
Thanks to your encouragement, not least. And just to help orientate listeners who maybe don't have a background in folklore studies, do you have a kind of like a short way of describing what it is beyond, because we know it's not just fairy tales, even though that is something that it is.
Yes, that is certainly a small piece of a much wider study. So I think, you know, certainly I think we all as folklorists struggle with what one of my former mentors, Larry Danielson, used to say is we needed our taxi cab definition of folklore. And I think we all still struggle with that for lots of reasons that I won't get into now. But I think, you know, the definitions that I appreciate include, you know, the things that one would expect, the idea of knowledge that we share with one another that's, you know, unofficial, that's become traditionalized and so forth. But I think teaching has taught me that the questions that really become sort of a losing game of is this folklore, is this not folklore, are really less helpful. Certainly we can identify processes and products that we would categorize as folklore, but I really try to think about the ways that folklore studies is about the kinds of questions we ask and who we ask those questions of. And so getting to the perspectives of groups and individuals, particularly groups and individuals who are heard from less in sort of more official spaces. So trying to get to the ground level of issues that are much more complicated than we may sort of hear about at the macro level. And so trying to get sort of an on-the-ground idea from people about, you know, sort of worldview issues and ways in which they're understanding their lives and the role of things like tradition and heritage and so forth.
That's a really great way of putting it. And it's also a great way of leading into your book, because you're covering people who are not heard from so often, tobacco farmers, and you're talking about tradition and heritage and how much more complex that is than may ostensibly appear. So tell us about a little bit about your book, Burley, and how it came to be.
Excellent. Yes, I did try to lead us right to the book.
Wow, you did very well.
Thank you. Because it does. I mean, I feel like that's what I wanted the book to be, at least, is something that would tease out what tobacco has meant to those who raise it or have raised it, beyond the many dominant narratives that we're all very familiar with, about obviously the effects of tobacco on our health and many other narratives that we are very familiar with. And so in terms of, you said how I came to the book, is that what I'm answering?
Yeah, how you came to the subject, because it's such an unusual and I think brilliant subject.
Well, I was living again in Kentucky in the late 90s and early 2000s, and tobacco was in the news all the time and part of conversations all the time, because there had been a number of sort of events that are important historically that were happening, or other sorts of changes that were taking place. The 1998 master settlement agreement between states and tobacco companies was understood to be a major changing point in the industry. And that led to, in 2004, what became known as the tobacco buyout, which was the end of the federal tobacco program that had been in place since the Depression era. So the way in which tobacco could be raised and bought and sold had been a federally regulated system. And so that changed in 2004. And so, not being from Kentucky, you know, I had, and I'll get to some of my sort of assumptions because that becomes really important. But, you know, I was just aware of that there were major shifts happening culturally. And so by 2004 and 2005, I was finishing up, or I was getting ready to begin my dissertation at Ohio State. And it just made sense that this was a topic that needed to be looked at. And I sort of, you know, in terms of we all have our narratives, I had in about 2000, I believe, which is unbelievable now to think about that that's 18 years ago. I was at a conference for women involved in agriculture as part of my job at the time. And I remember this conversation that I had with a woman who had not grown up farming, but she'd married a tobacco farmer, and she was at this conference in order to learn some ideas about what kinds of things they might try to produce on their farm in order to keep the farm. And she talked about how for her husband, tobacco farming was, and I don't remember that she used these words, but my, you know, what I sort of came away with is the way in which tobacco was about his identity. And it was about his ties to his family history. And it was about so much more than the crop itself or, you know, the sort of the economic aspects of it. And so thinking about that then a few years later, I became really interested in thinking about how that memory of that conversation suggested a really gendered perspective on tobacco that I hadn't heard anyone sort of mention. And so I became really interested in thinking about sort of, you know, documenting in the moment these changes that I saw that were happening, but also thinking about it in terms of tobacco really as a crop that's very much sort of embedded in masculine identity, a particular masculine identity in Kentucky.
Right, this tobacco man image and persona, yes, which is all the way through the book. It's informed by this persona, which is fascinating. Just before we move on and talk about some of the assumptions you came to the project with, I want to just look at some part of your introduction, which is on the history of tobacco growing generally, and then more specifically in Kentucky, and come back to a couple of the terms that you just mentioned. You just mentioned the tobacco buyout, which happened in 2004. Am I right in thinking this is when, amongst other things, government subsidies for tobacco farmers ended? Is that right?
It's mostly right, yes. There was never actually a subsidy, which is part of a much larger misunderstanding. So that's not exclusively yours, but yes. So, the federal government regulated, how much tobacco you could legally sell. And so there was sort of a relationship between the tobacco industry and the government and farmers that each year, based on a quota that you basically, when you bought land in Kentucky, it did or did not have a tobacco quota. And so, that quota rose and fell each year based on a number of factors, but basically demand. And so, and with that, sort of in exchange for agreeing to limit your production to that quota, you were then guaranteed a minimum price. So again, each year, the minimum price on different grades of tobacco was determined. And so you knew when you took your tobacco to be auctioned that you would get no less than whatever that minimum price was, hopefully more. So that was sort of the trade-off, a growing quota in exchange for knowing that you were guaranteed a market and a minimum price. So that's what ended in 04.
Right. That's what Okay. That's what I got mixed up on. I think of that kind of, it kind of translates into my head as a subsidy, even though you've completely explained that it's not a subsidy. And so that was a very important date. But before that, another really important date was 1964, by the looks of things.
Yes, absolutely. So in January of 1964, the first Surgeon General's report on the dangers of smoking was released. Obviously, this was not the first clue that anybody had. That had begun, well, depending on how you think about it, much, much earlier. But in 64, when the Surgeon General's report came out, that's really widely seen as a major turning point where it became clear that basically that the industry was in trouble. And so lots of, as we know now, lots of laws went into place in terms of different types of bans on advertising and leading up to, of course, total bans on smoking in public places and so forth, as we see today. So, yes, that was sort of a tide-changing moment. And in fact, just really quick, I just love the fact that they released the report on a Saturday out of fear of what it would do to the stock market. So I think it was a big deal.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, I noted that when you described it. But this was particularly significant for Kentucky because it was Kentucky's top cash crop for quite a while. Can you tell us a little bit about the history of tobacco in Kentucky specifically?
Yes, absolutely. So without, and I will get not very detailed, but certainly tobacco has historically been an was the biggest cash crop in Kentucky since European settlers brought it here from Virginia. And the history of tobacco more widely, different types of tobacco were developed in different regions based on climate and land and so forth. And then those sort of led to different uses. And again, because of by the 1930s, the federal tobacco program, those types of tobaccos really, because you had to have a quota to sell it, the different types of tobacco and the cultures that grew around them really became settled in very specific areas. So central Kentucky up to northern Kentucky in particular is the center of the Burley tobacco production. Burley is grown in some other places, but that was, and other tobaccos are grown in Kentucky, particularly western Kentucky. But Burley became settled Burley tobacco became settled in central Kentucky. And Kentucky ended up really behind North Carolina as the second biggest tobacco producing state, and still is the second biggest tobacco producing state.
Right. And the fact that it's Burley tobacco as opposed to just any old tobacco is important, isn't it?
Yes, but I would say that I've done a little bit of field work, for instance, in western Kentucky with what's called dark tobacco. And so just enough to know that in each region, the type of tobacco grown there has, its unique culture, which is tied up in both the economy and the culture in ways that are related in part to identity. So, yes, I start out the introduction of the book. I mention Martin Henson, who was my my main teacher. When the first time I interviewed him and I said, we're talking about tobacco, he corrected me and he said, no, Burley tobacco. So absolutely, the fact that it's Burley is central. But again, that would be true of other types in other places, or at least it would have been at one time, probably less so today.
So you mentioned a little bit earlier that you came to it with some assumptions, and I wondered what some of those assumptions were and how they were dispelled in the course of your field work.
So yes, absolutely. We all come to whatever project we come to with assumptions, and I think some of the most important parts of whatever that project is realizing those assumptions that were maybe not even totally sort of obvious to us. And so, again, I came to this right as the buyout was happening. What I later realized, I had really sort of assumed from the media rhetorics and so forth, was the idea that tobacco was about to be gone. And so I came to the documentation of tobacco, tobacco at that time, with the idea that I would be doing a lot of documenting of the last crop, talking to farmers about how it feels to raise your last crop. What I discovered, of course, is that there were farmers who had raised or were raising their last crop, but many, many farmers were far from it and had no intention of leaving tobacco. So that was one huge assumption, this idea of the last crop. The other huge assumption, which I think shows my complete naivete, is that I really thought I could study tobacco separated from, the very fact that tobacco is a cancer-causing product, that it is an industry that is perhaps the most deceptive and illness-causing in our history at that time, anyway. And so I really had a very naive understanding of the tobacco situation. I think what that really helped me to see ultimately, and I think this is why it's so important to reflect on our assumptions, is the ways in which I needed to figure out where I got those ideas. Where did I get the idea that this was going to be the last crop, and so forth. And so that really led me to understanding, and I think in the introduction, I quote from the first interview I did with Robert Taylor of Bracken County, Kentucky, who talked about when I asked him a question that I used a lot to sort of, can you walk me through the production year? And tobacco has a very specific production cycle. It's often referred to as a 13-month crop because you're often finishing up and selling your crop at the same time that you're starting the next year's crop. And so I asked him to walk me through, you know, what's that production cycle like? And he said something like, do you want me to tell you about how we do it now or how we did it in the olden days? And that came to me to be a real framing for how I began to understand tobacco production in Kentucky as really being about change, sort of changes that had happened and were happening, but more importantly, the changed meanings of the crop. So within the lifetime of those from whom I was learning, you mentioned, again, the 1964 change. So for older farmers, you know, that was within their lifetimes. And so the changes that they had seen happen, really were embedded in the way that they talk about and understand.
Right. And so we're going to go on in a minute to the book is divided into three parts. And the first part is looking at this 13-month production cycle. But just before we go on, I want to mention something that you have talked about in your introduction, which is your own initial tendency to romanticize, in a way, the growing tradition. Is, I think there's a point at which you're asking a farmer, but are you growing? Will you always just grow a little bit just because it's a tradition? You don't say it quite like that. And he's kind of saying, no, I'm doing it because it pays. It makes money. That made me laugh because that's what my questions are like. It's like, oh, are you doing this because it's part of your heritage? You know, you're from, I'm researching tango at the moment. So I'm looking at people in America dancing tango. And I'm, oh, are you embracing your Italian heritage via Argentina in dancing tango? It's like, no. No.
Yes. Yeah. And that's absolutely, that's one of those assumptions that I think, you know, I had from a lot of different sources, right? And so again, really important to my research process was understanding where I was getting these ideas. And again, back to that conversation I remembered from 2000 at the Kentucky Women in Agriculture Conference. This woman had told me, you know, my memory of it is that, and this was, as I came to learn, this was quite common that there were farmers who had what are called public jobs, meaning off-farm jobs, but raised tobacco on the side. And what she told me, or again, what I remember her telling me is that, you know, he was going to do that no matter what happened. Like it was so important to him symbolically to continue to do that. And so that really framed a lot of how I started out. And then, yes, farmers would say, well, I'm not stupid enough to keep raising it if it's not making money, you know. And so what I, you know, yeah, and it's amazing when you think back to your assumptions, especially. And I think, you know, folklorists, we're a bit sort of in danger of that romanticizing. We sort of walk a line where we need to, be really reflective on our assumptions about tradition and heritage and what those things mean. And so I really came to understand tradition from the perspective of tobacco farmers as being this threaded mix of both the economic and the more symbolic. And, you know, they're not fully separable. One of the farmers that you, maybe the person you're quoting, I think he really stressed that he would not do it if it didn't pay. Whereas other, you know, obviously their farmers are on a spectrum. And so those economic and those other cultural meanings are intertwined in a way that it's not a simple process of this is economic and this is cultural.
Right. Because I think actually at the end of the introduction, you quote, I think it's possibly the son of a tobacco farmer he's asking you to romanticize the crop, make it intimate, he says, or make it clear that there's hands that touch this stuff and there's lives that are dependent on it. He says something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So that, you know, so we can't deny that connection is there, right? That is part of the tradition. I mean, we're talking, you don't sort of decide, when you're 18 and you graduate from high school, I think I'll become a tobacco farmer. It's, It's very much embedded in family life and family history and so forth. So there is very much that that aspect of it that, you know, is connected to identity, particularly to male identity, which I could talk about later if you'd like. But in ways that, you know, and I think it also actually that I'm glad you drew attention to that quote, because putting, I think it was probably John Schell, in contrast with the farmer I was talking about earlier, who said he wasn't stupid enough to keep growing it, you know, that shows the spectrum of perspectives, right? That there, this young guy, very much has a romantic, and he was, I believe, 17 or 18 at the time. So there is a romance, to it for him at that time, versus, Roger Quarles, who was probably in his late 60s at the time. So very different perspectives. And that's, you know, and that I think that that's one of the things as folklorists that we continuously, and I think importantly, offer is that, you know, I can't talk about Kentucky tobacco farmers as having one perspective or one voice or one way of seeing the world, right? And that's what our long-term fieldwork leads us to, is the very fact that, you know, I'm going to hear very different things from very different people who from the outside appear to be a group, right, that have all of these things in common.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll move on to part one of the book, which is the Burley tobacco crop year then and now, and is a look at this 13-month tobacco cycle as how it's done now and in the past. And in the part that's about how it's done now, you also had your hand on the tobacco. I think you had your hands touching the stuff, in the word of that young man who wanted you to talk about that. So tell us about the 13-month tobacco cycle then and now, and the process of doing it yourself.
Okay, I will try and sum up 13 months in just a few minutes.
Yes.
Yeah, so tobacco is a crop that, and without getting into all different types and the different production methods for different types of tobacco, but Burley continues to be a crop that has a lot of needs for hands-on work, and has very specific stages from, you know, sowing the seeds, which are sown in some sort of seed bed and then transplanted to the field. So there are the very specific steps there are with any crops, but the way that tobacco is talked about and really the steps that are involved are very particular to tobacco. And so the first third roughly of the book, I go through that 13-month cycle as I learned about it from farmers. I will say that when I was writing, I guess it was the dissertation version, a now good friend of mine who is a tobacco extension agent read through it and pointed out all the things that farmers told me that weren't quite right, and which I think really points to our work as folklorists and my interest in getting across what farmers told me, not as always fact, but as this is how farmers understand it.
Can you give me an example of that?
Yes. Let me think about that and come back to it.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry.
No, no, no.
I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, not at all. But yes, there are a number of, I'm trying to think, because there's one example that he was really adamant about. So I'll be thinking about that as I talk. But so the first part of the book really takes us through those 13 months and through what farmers taught me, which again goes back to this idea that the way that it's talked about is really sort of focused on change and how changes have been made. And so as I started to say that the plants are started they're started in seed beds, but now today they're actually started in floating styrofoam trays. And so, you know, farmers talk about each step of the growing season and the growing in terms of how they were and how, you know, how it was done and how it is done today. And so I try to present again this this 13-month cycle as it was taught to me by the farmers.
I love the way that you talk about some of the things that happen in the course of this. For example, this when the tobacco is growing, there's this kind of, I think one farmer describes the family ritual of having to come out and look at it and go, oh, that's wonderful.
Yes. And the photographs, there's a tradition of taking photographs, family pictures in front of the tobacco at various stages of growth, so you can track through family pictures how tall the tobacco was at this time of year, in this particular year, and, when it was a good tobacco year based on not just how tall it was, but all different aspects of how it looks and so forth. So, yes, absolutely. That way in which, and again, sort of one of those things that I learned that did certainly need to be questioned and yet is important for tobacco farming families is the stress on the importance of family labor. And that varies much more widely from family to family and region to region and, size of your farm and so forth, how much was family labor and how much was hired labor and so forth. But it was this idea of the 13-month crop also really demonstrates the way in which tobacco is embedded in family life throughout that 13-month cycle.
Another thing that's emphasized is this the pride taken in producing a good hand of tobacco. Can you tell me a little bit about this? What is a hand of tobacco?
Yes, so sort of toward the end of the tobacco production cycle in those last couple of months after tobacco has been, so just really quickly, again, we've got the starting of the seeds, the transplanting of those seeds to the field, and then various stages of upkeep of the crop throughout, and then finally, topping it, which is breaking out by hand the flower of each plant, and then eventually cutting it, letting it sit on tobacco sticks in the field to begin to cure, and then after about 3 days being hung in the barn. Again, all of this still today is almost exclusively done by hand. And so once it's then cured in the barn for a number of weeks, depending on all kinds of weather conditions, it is, taken down from the barn, brought into what's called a stripping room, where the leaves are stripped from the stalk. And so up until the early 1980s, the custom was and had been that as leaves were stripped from the stalk, you held them in your hand, and then there was a special leaf that was used called a tie leaf that was tied around the stems of that stalk. So the idea of tying a pretty hand of tobacco, and pretty is the most common adjective used to describe a good hand of tobacco. So that was a huge source of pride, is that, and one of the things, again, I talk about is that sort of confluence of the economic reasons for that, as well as the more sort of symbolic meanings of a pretty hand of tobacco. The prettier it was, according to, and this changed depending on the needs of the tobacco companies, and what pretty really also reflected the coloring of the tobacco and so forth, which also then reflected what the current demands from the companies were. So there's this confluence of that pretty hand reflecting what the market wanted at the time. But also the skill in tying it and tying it in this, which it doesn't sound difficult, but I've done it. It's quite difficult. So the hand of tobacco, again, it was the early 1980s when Burley tobacco moved from being hand tied into being basically packed into a baler and baled into small bales that weighed 75 to 100 pounds. But the hand of tobacco, remained and remains of symbolic importance in terms of, because on a number of occasions when I was stripping tobacco, which is the process of taking it off the stalk, farmers would tie a hand. And I think I talk about in the book, probably Martin Henson, you know, so I'm stripping tobacco with him, and I turn around and he says, here's a hand I tied for you. You take that home. You know, the hand of tobacco continued to have a really important symbolic function.
It's like giving you a bunch of flowers or something.
Yes.
And actually, one of the things I noticed from living in Kentucky those 2 years that I was at Western is that it is a beautiful crop. I mean, the way it looks so dramatic when it's hanging in the specially designed barns and beautiful leaves when it's still in the field. It's a lovely looking plant.
Absolutely. We're folklorists, right? So we know that there are all kinds of aesthetic dimensions to work, right? To all aspects of life. There are ways in which, part of what we're interested in as folklorists is understanding what those aesthetic dimensions mean, right? So a pretty crop of tobacco and the use of the word pretty, particularly, again, aligning with a crop that is so tied up with male identity, is a fascinating topic that I could talk about for hours, but I'll.
So just before we move on to the second section, I just want to come back to that agent who was saying, no, that's wrong. Was one of the things he was concerned about the weight of the tobacco, that farmers were saying it weighed so much and he was saying, no, it weighs so much? I'm feeling like I remember that from somewhere, or am I deluding myself?
No, you're absolutely right. And I think it was dispute over how much a bale really weighed, and the idea that farmers always overestimated the weight, which I think, and I don't remember now how much I said about this in the book, but certainly that suggests, you know, the symbolic weight to farmers is tied up in the, you know, the actual calculable weight of tobacco. Those kinds of discrepancies are the things that that he was interested in. And I think I added a few footnotes, you know, to explain for him.
Right. So in part two, you're talking about the shifting meanings of tobacco. And here you move away from the direct field work into this archival research and this analysis of the rhetoric that you find in archival research. And I think your interest in all of this came about during a visit to the Kentucky Department of Agriculture in 2007. Is that right? When you saw something was not represented. Tell me what happened.
Yes, absolutely. So I was at the offices of the Kentucky Department of Agriculture, and actually not directly related to my research, although that it was in process at the time. But there was this beautiful wall of photographs of Kentucky agricultural products, including, and I more recently have written a little bit about this, including a bottle of bourbon. But there was no tobacco there. And I just was so struck by the fact that I'm spending my days with farmers for whom, you know, who live here in Kentucky and for whom this is their most important crop. And there was no image of tobacco in the Kentucky Department of Agriculture in this beautiful wall of photographs. And so I became really interested in understanding when that had changed, or had it changed, or, you know, sort of how is it that the Department of Agriculture is not showing this visual connection to the importance of tobacco in Kentucky. And so I ended up spending all kinds of rainy days and other down days during my fieldwork in the Kentucky Department of Libraries and Archives, going through the Kentucky Department of Agriculture newsletters, beginning when it started in the 1940s, up through, and it was monthly and then quarterly until, I believe, the 1980s, but going through all of the newsletters and trying to understand, how tobacco was understood there. And so the second part of the book is really, really focused in on specifically the newsletters as the rhetorical site that the state claimed, you know, the rhetorical space that the state claimed as an outward perspective on what Kentucky agriculture means. And so looking at it became clear as I went through the newsletter that there was a shifting attention to, first a shift in the way that the attention was paid to tobacco, and then finally a shift away from tobacco at all. And so I became really interested. That became a central part of the book, of my research and of the book, was this rhetorical analysis of this shift from this very self-evident crop, this crop that was part of life and it was an accepted part of life, to a much more self-conscious crop that became eventually really relabeled as heritage and therefore in the past.
Right. Even though it's not really in the past, which is another thing you cover in the book, isn't it?
Yes. And certainly, undeniably, tobacco production has declined massively and continued to decline, certainly since my research, obviously. But the way in which the sort of rhetorical decline was happening didn't align neatly with numbers, right? And so I was asked, you know, or people would comment over and over when I was in Kentucky and they'd hear that I was doing tobacco field work, they'd say, oh, you know, there used to be so much tobacco raised and now it's all gone. And so there was this really pervasive, again, this is one of those assumptions that I had come into the research with, was like, I'm going to document their last crop, you know, and that's not at all what was happening for thousands of farmers. So that chapter, or that middle section of the book, really looks at the shifting meanings, you know, from tobacco as the crop that we raise and the crop that, you know, we depend on for our livelihood, to, you know, a stigmatized crop and you know, one in which people are less and less aware that it even exists. And I think one of the statistics that I'm sure I say in the book at some point that really demonstrates that major shift is that in 1959, tobacco was grown on 80% of the farms in Kentucky. And by 2007, it had dropped to 10%.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, yeah.
And so, and the actual amount is not statistically sort of equivalent to that, but in terms of the people raising it, right, the decrease is immense. But I think the back to that 80% in 1959 demonstrates, you know, how much it, you know, as people still tell me, how it was part of life, right? It's a central aspect of life, and this idea of the 13-month crop, you know, this ever-present aspect of farm life in Kentucky.
So this section has two chapters. One is called Tobacco's Move from Self-Evident to Self-Conscious Tradition, and the second is called Tobacco Under Attack, and then Hello Heritage is the subtitle. And the last part, that you've got various images from the newsletter in these chapters, and the last one in the chapter four, the first of the two chapters, is Burley Tobacco's centennial year, 1964, which coincides with the this Surgeon General's report on the health hazards of tobacco. And then we move to Tobacco Under Attack. How quickly does the representation of tobacco in the newsletter change?
Really, very slowly and subtly. Although that one's that, I'm glad you point out that 1964 newsletter, because it's not at all subtle, because it was January when the Surgeon General's report had come out that we talked about earlier. And beginning in February, that tag at the bottom of sometimes every page of the newsletter, sometimes just the front page, celebrating the centennial year, which really is a longer story about, how the Burley plant became created through other from a different type, but so that that centennial year was really a talking back to the Surgeon General's report that had happened that January.
Okay, so it's quite
and that
bullish.
What was your question? I'm sorry.
I was curious as to how quickly the rhetoric changed. So it was this very kind of like promoted as both the self-evident and self-conscious tradition over the years. But then you describe how it becomes erased in the pages and on the walls of the Kentucky Department of Agriculture and in the pages of their newsletter. How did you see that process evolving?
Yes, and I think some of the images that I included demonstrate, for instance, the ways in which the label of tobacco as tradition to tobacco as heritage. I talk in part about how that shift, we sort of rhetorically use heritage to reflect when something has become much more self-conscious, when we're more aware of it because of some sort of threat. And so the movement from the 40s and 50s to tobacco from tradition to heritage is part of the shift that happened gradually. I talk about through the 70s, especially this emphasis on tobacco as heritage was very evident in the newsletter as it shifted to something that, was needed to be defended. So there's this, that chapter, as you said, is called Tobacco Under Attack, as it began to be understood as being under attack. And the, I talk about the ways in which the Department of Ag as the, spokespeople for Kentucky agriculture were absolutely very tied up in the rhetoric of the industry itself. And we all know, famously, we know much more today about the tobacco industry and the ways in which they, all of their deceptive practices and all of the ways in which they worked to keep the cancer causing and other risks of tobacco sort of under wraps for many years.
So then we can move on to part three, which is titled Raising Burley Tobacco in a New Century. And it's here that you're really combining your field work with this analysis of rhetoric. And you're looking at what it means to be a tobacco farmer in the modern, you don't say modern now, do you? But in recent years and how this has become a stigmatized identity. And I think you've got a quote from somebody who raised tobacco with her family, her husband and his family. Her name's Kathleen Bond. And she says, when we got married and raised tobacco, it was a good, honest way to make a living. And at the time we got out, and you put in square brackets, that was in 2003. If you raised tobacco, you were dirt, you were contributing to cancer. And then you go on to detail what it meant to be a tobacco man, particularly because, as you say, it is very gendered, and how that has been, how that has changed, and how it's affected the people who are or were tobacco men, and it's very poignant. So I should stop summarizing this part.
No, you're doing a beautiful job.
In fact, ask you, tell me about this fascinating final section, because I just think it's wonderful. It's so thought-provoking.
Well, thank you. And thank you for, I'm glad that the structure of the book came clear. So the first section is very much, my an account of my field work and what farmers taught me. The second section is stepping back and looking at the larger rhetorical picture of tobacco and how it changed. And then, yes, in the third section, I'm trying to bring those together. And I think, as I said early on, when we started out today, I really thought when I started this research that the tobacco industry was very separate from, and from what I was interested in and so forth. But when people like Kathleen Bond started expressing the kinds of things that, is in the quote that you just read, it really made me pay attention to the fact that as tobacco changed, that really resonated in the lives of people who are raising tobacco. The idea that, as we became more and more aware, obviously, of the effects of tobacco use that had direct impact and led to, you know, this idea of, as Irving Goffman called it, a spoiled identity, right? It became a stigmatized crop, and those who raised it, even within Kentucky, the second largest tobacco state, became sort of a stigmatized category of people.
One of the things I was really surprised by is that you detailed this study which shows about people's attitudes to those involved in the tobacco industry. And I would kind of expected people to have been angry with the huge corporations that had been shown to have deliberately deceived potential buyers. But there was also an awful lot of antagonism towards the farmers themselves. They're certainly not divorced from this sense of feeling of having that buyers can't trust people involved in the industry.
Yes, absolutely. And that was that became clear partly through, again, that middle section looking at the Department of Ag newsletters, but also through looking at, I also tracked news coverage over decades as well, went back to old news coverage and so forth. So it became really clear that the tobacco industry did a really good job of sort of bringing tobacco farmers under their wing in terms of public, the management of their public persona, so that they successfully aligned farmers with the industry in ways that, as the industry then began to be understood as the incredibly persuasive and evil industry that it is, farmers were sort of taken along with the industry in that sense. There's a lot more work, I think, that could be done on this, but it's at some point I briefly sort of contrast that with coal and the coal industry, Kentucky's other massive industry, and the ways in which the different histories of those industries made it such that we have some empathy toward coal miners in ways that we haven't had toward tobacco farmers, right? So we've got these two massive industries that have their violent histories in both cases, and polluting histories and health damaging histories and so forth. And yet the tobacco industry successfully sort of enclosed farmers in the industry in a way that, makes us, even here in Kentucky, makes people see tobacco's farmers as part of the problem, as opposed to, yet another victim of the industry. And not that farmers anyway, tobacco farmers would ever want to be classified as victims. So, but, that there's a way in which they're sort of enclosed in the blame in ways that we don't see coal miners in quite the same way. Or we didn't. I think that may be changing.
I was curious about that because I think maybe people involved in the fracking industry or the mountaintop removal when it gets to that stage, I think there might be, I was wondering if there was more kind of spoiling of identity going on there than in the past.
I'm not going to claim to be qualified to talk about that, but I think you're absolutely right that it's become much more complicated. It is interesting to sort of think about the histories of those two industries and how,
right.
and the roles of those who are the workers and those are who, and this is simplistic and yet not, right? Like where the power is.
Right.
In the case of the tobacco industry, they did a really good job. And again, this is back to that middle section of the book, the Department of Ag was absolutely complicit in this way in which farmers were wrapped in the industry and presented, as central, which they were obviously central to the industry, but in ways that, made people ask questions that I talk about in the book and articles as well of, why don't they just raise something else? Why?
Right.
Sort of blame.
So, yeah, I wanted to get into that a little bit because the two chapters in this section One is called, titled, this is chapter six, Now is the Good Old Days, Burley Tobacco Production and Nostalgia. And then chapter seven is, Why Can't They Just Grow Something Else? The Challenges of Replacing Burley Tobacco. So why is there this particular nostalgia? What does it mean to be a tobacco man? And why can't they just grow something else?
Do we have another hour? Teacher.
Right.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things, you know, as you're, you know, I think the process of field work is sort of, you know, listening and sort of, and as I stress with my students, the transcription process is so important because you hear it in new ways. Listening to the sort of patterns of what you're hearing and the ways in which, again, sort of reevaluating our assumptions throughout all of it. And so tobacco farmers really, I think, farmers in general, I think, sort of nationwide, there's this sort of stereotype of farmers as resistant, as conservative. And I don't just mean politically, but, resistant to change and so forth. And this idea, again, that I really certainly started out with in doing this research, that they were always looking back at better days and so forth. And so what particularly that first chapter in the third part, chapter six, is about is the ways in which, in fact, what farmers taught me is that when they see a change that is going to make their work more efficient, a combination of saving time, but also not sort of, being detrimental to the crop and so forth. There's this sort of confluence of aspects of what efficiency means. But, that quote, now is the good old days, which again, was Martin Henson, one of my primary farmer teachers. This understanding that when changes have come that they've seen as beneficial, that have been, efficient and so forth, they embrace those changes. And in some cases, they even led those changes. So we talked, for instance, earlier about the move from tying tobacco in those pretty hands, that bundle, to packaging it in different ways. And there were a couple of different ways that were tried. But there are stories about farmers who, because again, this is, it's more complex than I have time for, but the packaging in hands was the only form that farmers were allowed to sell it in. And so packaging it in bales, which they later did, sort of slowly started to happen. And farmers would drive hours and hours to somewhere where they could sell it in bales as they figured out how to make that work and how it would make their work more efficient, not easier, but more efficient. But there was this rhetoric that I certainly bought into of that farmers were resistant to moving from hands to bales, when in fact, what I learned is that now is the good old days really symbolizes the ways in which when changes were seen to work in ways that benefited them, they were perfectly willing to embrace them.
Right. And you stressed this several times over. So I'm guessing you're pushing back against quite a strong message that is received, that these people are not embracing change. But that does bring us to this final chapter of why can't they just grow something else? And I think this is, as you detailed, there's this thing about being a tobacco man, and it does tend to be a man, as opposed to tobacco men and women, as somebody else puts it. But it's this relationship with the crop, which involves a performance of particular skills, a knowledge of an aesthetic system. And also this person who has this knowledge and performs these skills is highly respected in the community. And moving on to bell peppers seems to be the most common replacement crop. Doesn't seem to work out. So why doesn't it work out? Is it because the knowledge and the performance of skills, the knowledge to create good bell peppers isn't there, or it's just...
It's, I think, as I really try to describe in this chapter, is again, it's a confluence of both tangible and intangibles. So, you know, to move your farming operation from tobacco to bell peppers, you have to learn what makes a good bell pepper and all of the steps in creating that. You have to switch up your equipment and your all your inputs into the land. You have to create a market. You know, there are all these tangible and intangible. Well, those are the more tangible, right? The ways in which shifting, there are tangible aspects to it. And bell peppers are the classic example from the 1980s and 90s, where these the pepper market farmers were basically, you know, here, buy these pepper plants and then we'll come back and buy them from you. So say these pepper companies, and then they wouldn't come back and buy them. And so tobacco farmers were out all kinds of money and other outputs, and left with rotting bell peppers. And there were other, lots of other sort of trendy crops that happened with, but bell peppers became like the classic example. But one of the many things that points out about tobacco is that that 13-month cycle, once you've got tobacco curing in the barn, it can sit there a really long time. I mean, I've wouldn't quote particular farmers, but I've heard stories about farmers who didn't like their price, so they waited a whole nother, you know, to the next year to try to get a better price. So, you know, it can sit there. And bell peppers just rot and turn to mush, right? And so that's sort of one really tangible way in which, you know, it's just shifting to another crop. There are a few crops that you could, you know, keep in your barn until the market improves, right? Most things are perishable.
Absolutely, yes. And also, you know, you've got all these skills and knowledge and that has been built up over generations, and then trying to switch it immediately to something else that is kind of new to you, and you and the market's still kind of fluctuating very much. I mean, that's so much change to have to embrace, not to mention how it looks on the landscape or how it affects your working day. I mean, I've just switched to a new computer and that's been very traumatic. And that's just a computer.
Yes. Yeah. And I think one of the things that's so unique about tobacco is what I just described in terms of it not being so perishable. And so first off, second off, since the, you know, beginnings of the tobacco program in the 1930s, there has been a market that's waiting. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't have to shop around to try and sell your tobacco. I mean, it's more complicated than that now, obviously, and always was, but in terms of which warehouse you went to and so forth, but you knew you had a market. And so one of the many gendered aspects of all of what this book is about is the ways in which that on farms where women were heavily involved, I found that those are the farms that the popular word is diversification. Those are the farms on which more diversification was happening and is happening is because of women's roles in helping to create markets and helping to do the marketing, because tobacco farmers didn't have to do any marketing. They raised a good crop. And they brought it to the warehouse and it was auctioned. And so asking farmers to raise something else, which is the sort of the rhetorical refrain in the late 90s and 2000s was, you know, why don't they just raise something else? Well, there are many, many, many reasons. But for one, you know, it's not just raising a different crop. It's an entirely different system. And so on farms where women were involved or are involved, even if farmers continued, and this goes back to that story I started with in 2000 with the woman at the Women in Agriculture conference, her husband was going to keep raising it, but she wanted to learn about other crops that could be raised as well.
So, Farrell, we're running out of time. I've already taken up an hour of your time. So I should wind up soon. Is there anything you want to say about the book that I haven't given you the chance to say?
I should have something ready to say about why it's important that you read this book. Hopefully
Well, I hope we've convinced everybody that they should read it. I think it's a wonderful book. And it is the winner of the Wayland Hand Prize from the American Folklore Society. So it's an award-winning book. So before I let you go, though, can you tell me what you're working on now in amongst all your many duties as professor and editor-in-chief of the Journal of American Folklore and so on and so forth?
Well, there are a few things, but the one I think that's most pertinent here is that as I was doing all of the tobacco research and writing about tobacco and so forth, that first conversation that I have talked about with the woman in around 2000 at the Women in Agriculture Conference stayed with me, not just in the sense that I was sort of viewing all of my research with a gendered lens, but I've also remained really interested in what women farmers are up to in Kentucky. And so over the last several years, I've been conducting interviews with women farmers, particularly women who are members of the statewide organization who sponsored that conference that year and continue to do so, called Kentucky Women in Agriculture. And so I've been in the process of documenting the sort of stories of women who are part of that organization or who are involved in other ways. At this point, it's I've created an archival collection here at Western Kentucky University. And so it's sort of been really about creating the collection for the organization and documenting their what they have to tell us about Kentucky agriculture from women's perspectives. And so that'll be, I've not done a lot of writing about that yet, but that'll be a piece sort of that will come next.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us for the New Books in Folklore podcast and talking to us about Burley Kentucky tobacco in a new century. And I will let you get on with your day. I just want to say thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, Rachel.